From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Last week, construction crews on the new eastern span of the Bay Bridge completed the big lift, dramatically shifting the weight of the new single-tower suspension span from temporary supports to a mile-long cable. The new section, set to open next year, is now officially the world's largest self-anchored suspension span. And we'll talk to some of the architects involved in the project and others, and you're invited to join us as well. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Construction on the new eastern span of the Bay Bridge, built after the damage caused by the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, began in 2002 and was scheduled for completion by 2007. It's now set to open in 2013, a total cost that have exceeded $6 billion. And the new eastern span, built for earthquake safety, includes a skyway and a unique suspension bridge with a 525-foot-tall suspension bridge tower made of four steel shafts. It is the longest self-anchored suspension bridge in the world. And in this hour, we want to focus on the Bay Bridge's new eastern span, as construction crews just last week completed the big lift, dramatically shifting the weight of the new single-tower suspension span from temporary support to a mile-long cable. And joining us for this discussion, before I introduce all the guests who are here, I wanted to announce the fact that you can go right to our website and actually see images we posted of what the bridge will look like when it's completed. You can go to kqed.org/forum. And, of course, you can also let us know any questions or comments you have by going to kqed.org/forum. And now let's meet who's with us for the hour here in studio. Donald McDonald is principal with Donald McDonald Architects. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you.
And Michael Fitzpatrick is a bridge architect as well. We've got two of the main guns here in terms of architecture with us, T.Y. Lin International. I should mention that Michael Fitzpatrick, Donald McDonald, and Clive Endres will appear at a panel discussion on Bay Bridge Design and Aesthetics tonight from 6 to 8 at the Aquarium of the Bay, Pier 39. Glad to have you with us now, Michael Fitzpatrick.
Thank you very much.
Also with us in studio is Clive Endres, and Clive Endres is a senior landscape architect with the California Department of Transportation. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we also have Bartnay with us. And Bartnay is Bay Bridge Communications Manager for the California Department of Transportation. Welcome, Bartnay.
Yeah, nice to see you again, Michael.
Good to see you again. And let me begin with you. And let's begin. Why a self-anchoring suspension bridge? I mean, we went through all kinds of things with retrofitting, how well I remember, and so forth. Well, how do we come to that?
Well, you know, the Bay Bridge has so many interesting stories. And we're focusing today on the architectural side of it. There was a process that was held to determine exactly what that signature span would be. In 2005, there was an assembly bill that passed, 144, that that basically stated that that process was going to be upheld, and the community actually picked a self-anchored suspension bridge as the signature span that would connect our skyway to the Yerba Buena Island transition. And there's a lot of history behind that decision. There were a couple of different design types that were looked at. Caltrans actually originally proposed a skyway all the way across. There was a cable stayed type of bridge, the kind that has cables that radiate straight down from the tower and hold up the deck. But ultimately, a self-anchored suspension bridge was chosen because it has that catenary drape, very like the Golden Gate or the West spans the Bay Bridge. That is the signature sort of this area. And not too many people know this, but if you went to the state archivist's office and pulled the design drawings like any state resident can do, you can find hand-drawn prints of a self-anchored suspension bridge designed dated 1932. So the design type had been looked at before in history, and now we're sort of realizing that design.
Well, we're going to talk about the design a lot here this hour and find out some of your thoughts about it. But as long as we're talking about the history, Clive Endres, well, you go back and you think about all the politics, too, involved in the history that before this bridge became realized.
That was a great part of the whole process of the design of the bridge, and that is that it was a great public process. There was certainly discussion. There was certainly tension, if you will, over what would the design be. We held numerous public hearings, all of the EDAP process, which was this process of a group of engineers and specialists in the design of bridges, got together on a monthly basis and worked with the design of the bridge. So it's just it was so important to get a design that fit with the Bay Area.
You had a lot of public pushback, too.
There was a lot of public pushback, but people showed up at those meetings. They made it very clear that they were looking for a structure that was a signature structure, if you will.
Do you think the five-year delay was a result of politics? I mean, that's often the argument. One hears Willie Brown and drilling on Yerba Buena Island, and Arnold talking about the viaduct, and Jerry Brown talking about a casino. I mean, like I say, there were a lot of things that sort of stood in the way of the thing moving on time.
Yeah, I'd probably defer to Bart on that, but I think, yeah, it was drilling on the island. We were held up for a year for a number of reasons.
And we won't even get it. We won't get into the China steel controversy,
exactly.
But I mean, a lot of politics here, Bart.
Well, there certainly are a lot of politics. We won't deny that. But there are a lot of other things that delayed us too. We really had to determine what type of design would be here. Caltrans came forward with a skyway design because we were looking at something that was very practical, was very A to B, and then we had to work with the local entities to determine exactly what it was that needed to be built here, because at the end of the day, we would not get to build anything if we did not find a way to come together. And so that's what was great about the legislation that was passed in 2005. The Toll Bridge Program Oversight Committee united the California Department of Transportation, the Bay Area Toll Authority, and the California Transportation Commission to oversee this project and shepherd it to where it is today.
When did you decide you wanted a signature span?
Well, I think that was something that came up as part of the process. When we put forward the Skyway design in public process, it was something there's where the pushback was. Basically, some of the articles said they didn't like the idea of a freeway on stilts. Certainly at Caltrans, we were saying, hey, the beauty is the bay itself. You know, you're not going to be going through this steel structure. You're not going to be Luke Skywalker on the Death Star run. You're going to be out in the open, taking the bay. And this is something that we know that we can build. And the region really wanted something that was more of a signature. I mean, bridges are in our DNA. We have arguably the most beautiful bridge in the world, the Golden Gate here. The West Spans are a close rival to that. Now we have the Alfred Zampa Memorial Bridge over there between Vallejo and Crockett. So it's our signature, and it's part of who we are.
And Clive, you were out there day to day in this whole process. When did you decide about the bicycle section? Because that was an extra $70 million.
It was an extra $70 million, and it was certainly a part of the design early on. And again, it was through that public process where we were working on, well, there was a real desire for a signature span, but it was the public meetings, and it was the people that showed up at those hearings. And I can tell you, it was the East Bay Bicycle Coalition that showed up in huge numbers at those meetings. They outnumbered most everyone at the meeting, you know, week after week, month after month. And they wanted that bicycle pedestrian pathway. So there was really no turning back. It was hard to say no. It was recognized by probably myself, by Donald, by many of us, that it was the right thing to do. This was the first chance we'd have to build a bicycle path that would start to take us across to the west, ultimately to San Francisco.
And this is no ordinary bicycle path. I mean, what we want to do with this speaker series is to invite in the Don McDonalds to explain just how unique an experience this is going to be. We didn't throw a stripe down on top of a bridge deck. We elevated and extended this bike path to create a unique experience. Right, Don?
Yeah, I think it's really important that the bike people re-added a humane element to the bridge. For instance, we lifted the bike path, like Bart was saying, up in the air. It's about 18 inches up, so the air can actually flow underneath it. The shape of the bike path is like an airplane wing. And so you get the wind. And so the car exhaust hopefully won't, you know, they're heavier than air. And if you can get some kind of circulation there, you can clean the air, at least for the bikers. And we also felt that it had to be wide enough to take a lot of traffic, because most people don't realize there's, on a big day on the Golden Gate, there's 8,000 cyclists that go across there, and there's about 60, 70,000 cars. Whereas the Bay Bridge has up to 300,000, so I'd expect 20 to 30,000 people a day going over there. So it has to be a major thoroughfare for the bicyclists, and it's close to go from the East Bay to San Francisco on a bike.
Well, I want to talk with you, Don McDonald, but also talk perhaps first with Michael Fitzpatrick just about the design, because Don took over in 1998, and he's designed over a dozen bridges in his career, we should add. And Michael Fitzpatrick was in on kind of, what, the first 30%?
That's correct.
So talk about your role, I mean, as things began to unfold and how things really came into focus.
Well, as Bart had talked about the EDAP process and 17 recommendations early on in the process, when there was an RFP released for the design, there was teams being formed, and on the teams you had to have a cable stay alternate and a self-anchored suspension alternate. And I was in charge of the cable stay alternate at that time. And it's really worth noting that the process that Caltrans instituted actually existed before Federal Highway's context-sensitive design program. And it was really pretty cutting edge at that time to have engineers, architects, all the people all in the mix of this design. And part of context-sensitive design is looking at the environment, what makes it special, what makes the area unique. And, of course, the Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge were great models. And when you look at the Golden Gate Bridge as an architectural skin, you know, for shadows, for casting shadows, light, day, seasons. But it's architectural. If you look below deck, you see the cross bracing. There's not the same kind of attention put there. And then the Bay Bridge is kind of form follows function, where there isn't any embellishment. It's just diagonal bracing, and it's always often the little sister of the Golden Gate Bridge. And if you look in 1997, 1998, most cable stay bridges were essentially sticks. They were a big concrete stick with cables coming from them. And it didn't have any of that allure, didn't have any, you know, it was very difficult to get them to have any kind of excitement. And so what we started experimenting with was splitting the tower and putting the tower in two pieces and linking the tower with, at the time, I didn't know what ductile link beams were, but splitting the tower so that the fog, the time of day, the shadows would get cast in the middle of the bridge. And it was pretty pretty revolutionary at the time, because most seismic design at that time was meant to resist earth forces rather than move with it. And so we started working on the cable stay bridge, where it would actually have the two shafts that would be ductile and move and be flexible. And it was very kind of revolutionary in terms of engineering design.
So as things unfolded, we're talking about aesthetics, but we're also talking about, of course, earthquake safety.
And, yes, yes.
Not just 150 years, as has often been reported, but 1,500, Don McDonald?
That's right. That's what it's designed for. So if we have an earthquake like 1906, it'll survive and people will be able to use it. So,
well, let's talk a little bit more about the aesthetics, though. I mean, this is a design that was self-anchored, cable stay bridge, Michael Fitzpatrick.
The cable stay bridge?
Yeah.
Well, the cable stay functions different than a self-anchored suspension bridge. The cable stay, basically all the forces go from the deck through the cable down to the tower.
Now, I wanted to get at not only function of the difference, but also the aesthetics, mm-hmm. I mean, and how they came to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one of the main forces, other than the idea of splitting the tower and having the link beams with the cable stay option, was what I called the volumetric experience. If you're going west from San Francisco across the existing bridge, you're below deck and you're in a volume. And then you go into the tunnel, you're in another volume. And then when you in the existing bridge, you're still in the volume. On the new bridge, when you're on the upper deck, you're on the top deck, and then you go through the volume of the trusses, then through the volume of the tunnel, then through the volume of the cables. It's very dramatic. There was an opportunity on the new bridge to create a transition space once you came out of the tunnel, or if you're heading west, to be inside the cables. And so one of the main forces, one thing behind the cable stay bridge was always about having a volume of cables, having the cables go to the outside so you actually drove through something. And in fact, the very early versions of the cable stay bridge had the cables to the outside of the deck, and then they transitioned to the center. So you went from the inside the cables to outside the cables and vice versa. But that ended up not working for seismic reasons, so that one went away.
And we've got five lanes in both directions, but not necessarily going to have relief of traffic in the long run here.
Yeah, I think one way to look at it, there's 8-foot lanes on either side of the five lanes, and so those are emergency lanes. And you don't have that on the bridge now. And when there is a tie-up, it's usually because one of the lanes are plugged, so I think Bart's can handle those. He's been in the traffic side.
Well, we've added the shoulders on the side of the bridge. So while we can't claim that we're increasing capacity, we can claim that we're increasing operational performance, because when we do have breakdowns, we can take that traffic out of the way now and keep the traffic moving more fluidly as soon as the new bridge opens.
Can you talk about the big lift last week, Don McDonald?
I mentioned earlier when we were talking outside the radio that I'm the architect, but I can say that the big lift went carefully and it was very slowly done, so there's no mistakes. But Bart, again, was right there following the process, and so it's more in his court than mine.
You want to give us a picture of what was going
on? Sure.
Right?
And the Bay Bridge is an amazing thing, right? It's this 2.2 mile long, the east span of it. The whole Bay Bridge is 8 miles long. We're talking about the eastern span that's being replaced. There have been a number of different engineering incredible feats that have had to be done. This was the biggest, where we have lifted 5,000 tons of steel before, 150 feet in the air, to slide in double decks and close the bridge for 3 days. This is an order of magnitude above that. This was 35,200 tons of steel being transferred from a temporary structure onto a cable system that that is new. Single tower, one cable looping around the west end, connecting into the east end. It was an amazing feat. It was our biggest risk in building the new Bay Bridge. And we never – there was never – like Steve Heminger said – there was never really a fear that this would fall into the water or fail catastrophically. But how long would it take to tune this harp? You know, would we be able to lift it right the first time? The aesthetics demand a lot out of the engineering on this bridge. And it's a tribute to American Bridge and Floor Enterprises and all of the support staff that they stayed out there in the morning and in the night, and they got it right the first time. And we don't have a delay in schedule because the load has been transferred and this self-anchored suspension bridge is supporting itself.
And Clive Enders, can you talk about the lighting? I mean, because that's all evolved. You've watched that whole evolution.
I've watched the whole evolution. It's again, you know, you perceive a bridge very differently at night versus how you perceive it during the day. But they're just both so important to the aesthetics, to the architecture of the bridge. We started, I think we recognized early the importance of the lighting. We hired a gentleman by the name of Howard Branston Associates back from New York. He'd lit the Statue of Liberty, done a number of very prominent projects around the country. And it was Howard Branston that developed the concept for the lighting. And the idea was, he always referred to it as an orchestrated event. Remember, this bridge is very long. It's 2.2 miles long. But the idea was that as you approach the main tower and the suspension span, that the lighting builds. It builds kind of, as in Howard's word, it's kind of like a crescendo in music. So as you start from either end, the light pole, the roadway standards build in height from 10 meters in height all the way up to 20 meters. And this entire crescendo, if you will, culminates at the top of the tower. So that's how he always referred to it. The interesting part is that was back in the year 1998, 1999. As we went through that design, we were using metal halide light. We always wanted a white light. Don, you know, the bridge is characterized as white. So the lighting seemed to work. The challenge was to get an even wash across the deck. That was a safety and operational concern. But as time has passed, we've been building this bridge now and designing it for the last 10, 12 years, technology changes. So we've moved into LED lighting. Most people are familiar with LED lighting, and it's very energy efficient. So we started looking at ways to save money on this project, on cost, on energy, and looking at LED lighting. But when you get into LED lighting, it presents a lot of additional challenges to the design. How do you get the same amount of light on the deck with this new type of light fixture? So we started to work with a couple of other companies, and I wouldn't hesitate to mention Musco Lighting back in Iowa, because they really stepped to the forefront with this LED technology, built models, worked with us to further the design and bring it into the 21st century, if you will.
So and here
it's been
we are.
An exciting process.
Don McDonald, you're really quite proud of this project. I mean, as well you should be, but also want the people of Oakland particularly to realize what they have.
Yeah, I think through the process, I've really wanted Oakland to, you know, how can I say it? I've never publicly gone out and said it, but it should become their bridge. And what's
just like the Golden Gate of San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the reasons it's white is we match the cranes in Oakland that are painted white. And the white shows, you know, it shows light better on the structure than, like, if we'd done, a cable-stayed bridge, like Michael was saying, you have a post and you have a bunch of wires, and they drop out in daylight. But in this case, we have these bigger cables that sort of frame the, what we call a veil of light when the lights are on, like lighting situation at Clive was talking about, so it becomes, we hope, a branding element that when you go on the bridge, you know, you see this white element and you relate to the cranes on the other side. And the other thing about the cranes is when we, in the early design, we moved the tower back and it offset the symmetry of the bridge. And that happened, it sort of tied itself into the cranes themselves. The catenary form off the crane and the back stays it on them now. So that's, I mean, when you go there, you'll look at it, and at a distance, you can match them up. So I felt that that was really pushing that idea of the white, and then also hoping that Oakland will brand itself with
a
bridge.
Let me push an idea here for listeners. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can. In fact, we welcome your calls and emails. You can join us. In fact, we invite you to do so if you have questions or comments about, well, let's call it the final product of the Bay Bridge or the whole process, the history, the aesthetics, the design, and particularly design. We have a couple of the architects here, but also the designers work very closely with the engineers, obviously, and we have Bartnay here to answer some of those questions. Pretty much anything's on your mind about the Bay Bridge, you can bring to the fore, and we welcome your calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, that's toll-free from wherever you're listening or however. Please feel free to join us, 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page, and, of course, go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can see these images by going to our website of the Bay Bridge as it will look when it is completely unveiled, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. But especially if you have any questions, feel free to join us by phone. Again, it's 866-733-6786. Don McDonald, can you talk a bit about how you worked with the engineers? I mean, how did that collaboration take place?
Well, I think what's interesting in the design of this bridge, the main part of the bridge that's the most hardest to engineer would be the tower. And that tower height was set by the EDAB, which is a group of professionals that were brought together by the state to analyze all these designs, and we had a competition between the cable stayed and the suspension bridge. And so once you work on the tower, that sets up a vocabulary. We take that vocabulary right through the bridge, and there's a thing like solids and voids, and the fact that we had these what they call link beams, those are little horizontal elements between the tower legs. We shaped the tower legs, and those shapes became, for instance, a light pole shape, so this pentagon. And then we brought it into the piers, which are the elements under the bridge that hold the main deck up, and we shaped those as well to pick up that. So this vocabulary goes from the tunnel to touchdown, and our main goal in this bridge was we had these five different segments, different methods of engineering throughout the project, and we wanted to tie them all together. And one of the ways we did it was to keep these shapes consistent throughout the bridge. It even goes down to the handrail. We turned the picket so they would pick up the same shadow lines that you get on the main tower. The other thing I want to mention, too, is that even in engineering, you can't design a bridge like an airplane, so to speak. Engineers always take the opinion that it should be beautiful just if you follow the mathematics. Well, it isn't always the case, and I always use the Golden Gate Bridge, like Michael mentioned earlier. There's redundancy in that bridge. There's a lot of elements that were done on that are non-structural. There are some elements on the tower that are redundant. The top part of the tower is not structurally. The link beams have a cover on them that's three times the size of the link beam itself. And the reason that was done was to give proportion to that bridge so it hopefully would be beautiful when it was done. And that's part of the process.
All right. We're coming up at a break here. We got to mention, just go back to the early stage before implementation. Michael Fitzpatrick, there was worldwide bidding going on. I mean, we need to mention the fact that once the bidding started, it came from all over the world.
Are you talking about the contractors? Yes. Of course, when you have a project of this size and this complexity, contractors would love to work on a project like this.
Well, we'll bring in our listeners when we return. Again, Michael Fitzpatrick and Don McDonald here with us in studio, the architects who have been involved in this extraordinary project. Clive Endres, senior landscape architect with the California Department of Transportation, and Bartnay, Bay Bridge Communications Manager for California Department of Transportation. You will be involved when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Last week, construction crews on the new eastern span of the Bay Bridge completed the big lift, dramatically shifting the weight of the new single-tower suspension span from temporary supports to a mile-long cable in the new section, which is set to open next year, is now officially the world's largest self-anchored suspension span. We're talking to some of the architects and others who were involved in this project, and with us in studio is Bartnay, Bay Bridge Communications Manager for the California Department of Transportation, and Clive Endres, who is Senior Landscape Architect with the California Department of Transportation, and Donald McDonald, Principal of Donald McDonald Architects, and Michael Fitzpatrick, Bridge Architect with T.Y. Lynn International. You wanted to add something, actually, Michael Fitzpatrick. Again, you were in the earlier part of the bridge construction, about the work with engineers, between the engineers and the designers, or the architects, yeah?
Well, yes, thank you. at TY Lin, we really think that coming up with a great design is a collaboration between engineer and architect. And often in the very beginning of the process, engineers are kind of trained in a very logical sense. You give them a problem and the most efficient answer is always the best answer. And architects are trained to enjoy the process. You know, there's a lot of discovery and mystery and it's not a linear process. And in the very beginning of a process like this, the engineers usually want to solve the problem. You want to get the forces to the ground, and it's a very linear process. And architects, you know, they're thinking about the beauty and what, like Don was talking about, the expression and the space and all these other things. And they're very, one is quantifiable, one's qualifiable. And I call it a tennis match that goes on where the architect has an idea that might not be intrinsically logical from an engineering standpoint, but it sparks an idea, and then the engineer kicks an idea back and says, "Well, what if we do this?" And it goes back and forth until those what were very divergent ideas become a singular vision. And Don could really talk about this a lot. Is one of the other parts of a project like this where you have several structure types. You know, the behavior of the self-anchored suspension bridge versus the skyway and how it actually functions is very different. And having a visual unity from end to end is often a challenge because you have different groups of engineers working in their pockets. And so one of the challenges that Don and I face on a daily basis is getting all of those different people working together in unison to come up with a vision that's from what Don says, from, you know, tunnel to touchdown. And it has to be willingness from everyone, especially Caltrans, to play. I always call it like playing tennis. You know, you smack the ball back and forth. And on the Bay Bridge in the early phases, everyone was really investigating forms rather than strictly an engineering solution.
It's more like making a major motion picture or something. I mean, so many people involved in different levels, and they all have to come together, as you say. Let's bring some of our listeners into this discussion and find out what's on their minds. And let's begin, Bill, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. As I recall, the bridge was patterned after a design of a bridge that exists in France, if I'm not mistaken. And in that bridge, it's rather spectacular because the cables actually unwind from the tower as they descend to the deck. And I was a little disappointed when I saw this design because it doesn't do that. And I was wondering why that is.
Donald McDonald.
Yeah. Oh, that's the Meilleur Bridge, and it's in France. The highest bridge, cable stayed bridge probably in the world right now. And it was designed by Foss, who was the main architect on it. I don't remember the French engineer, but it's a very simple system. It's a tower. The tower is beautifully sculptured. The cable system it's in one line. It goes down between the two decks. It's not a wide bridge like our bridges are, but it's a cable stayed bridge, and it's not in the same class at all. But it is a beautiful bridge.
You kept mentioning that French bridge, though, and as soon as he said that, Bart and I started shaking his head no. I mean, because it kept coming up in conversation. I remember when we started talking about after the Loma Prieta what would happen.
Right, and we have a really interesting sequence of events that happened here that was shepherded by the Metropolitan Transportation Commission and a community group that was led by Mary King and informed by the EDAP. There was a whole process of determining what the design type would be right here. The self-anchored suspension bridge, the largest of its type in the world, was selected primarily for aesthetics, but also because it responded to some engineering challenges as well. The western spans of the Bay Bridge have a center anchorage that has more concrete in it than the Empire State Building in New York. And by building a self-anchored suspension bridge, we didn't require to have to anchor those cables in that manner out there on the eastern side of the bay. So you can't really divorce the engineering and the architecture in the process here. They had to be kind of gone at the same time. And while you've assembled, Michael, an amazing brain trust of the design responsibility there at this table, there's no Howard Rourke of the Bay Bridge. There's no Frank Lloyd Wright. There's no single vision that actually drove. It is actually a team of people that have worked together through a process involving the community that arrived at this design.
So collectivism really can work, is what you're saying. Huh?
Despite Ayn Rand's best, you know, I love the Fountainhead. Sometimes it can.
Ayn Rand, Paul Ryan. Yeah, the list goes on. Let me bring another caller in here. And Kevin, that's you. Hi, Kevin. You're on.
Hi, Michael. I am an avid cyclist in San Francisco who works in tech. And I would sure love to be able to cycle from one Oakland to San Francisco. Maybe Peter Rourke and Peter and Howard from Ayn Rand would have been able to include a bike lane in the bridge. I'd be wondering what the reason is that I'm not going to be able to do that from San Francisco to Oakland.
Yeah, a lot of emails about this, Clive Endress. Why not do it on the West Van?
Well, I don't think there's ever been an answer that we wouldn't do it on the West Van. We're studying adding a bicycle pedestrian path to the West Van. The funding for the East Van funded the new East Van. And again, as I mentioned, the Bicycle Coalition was out there in force. We agreed to build this bicycle path on the new East Van. It's to the south side of the bridge. But I would answer your question by just keep your ears open because we're studying it, and it will probably be fulfilled sometime here in the future.
We did a study in 2001.
Michael Fitzpatrick.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Actually, right now we're working on the next phase of that study on how to get pedestrians from Yerba Buena Island over to San Francisco. Has a lot of challenges, and especially the grades and vertical clearances, and again, engineering concerns about adding weight to the West Span. So it is being looked at and being evaluated, and how to best connect San Francisco to Yerba Buena Island.
All right. When there's any design, there's always criticism. Here's Greg from our Facebook page who writes, "It's a bridge, all right, and it's nicer than the old steel span it's replacing, but I wouldn't expect to see it on any postcards. In a word, underwhelming."
Well, it's already on postcards, and it's on the Warriors' jerseys, and it's in at various different car lots and different places of business. So we're already seeing the iconic nature of this design emerge before it's even open.
And here's Connie, who writes, "It would be great if you all gave a shout-out to all the men and women who built the bridge. I used to work as a project manager in commercial construction, and all too often the ingenuity and micro-level knowledge and expertise that the construction workers brought to the projects to solve problems and figure out how to actually build and make real the designs was lost in the shadows of the engineers, architects, and so forth." Fair enough.
Well, gentlemen, can we give a collective amen? I mean, amen to that. Yes. You know, the workers out there have been just tremendous on this project. They are the reason why we're going to have a bridge. There were extreme learning curves that had to be overcome by the skilled trades that were out there. Some of them missed Super Bowls because they had to work on the bridge. It's a testimony to trying to provide the seismic safety that the region needs.
And on our Facebook page again, Noah writes, "They should keep both bridges up. You can pay at your own risk $4 toll for the old bridge and $8 for the safer new bridge." That's a radical suggestion. Here's a listener who says, "This has to be one of the most unrealistic, romantic indulgences in all our infrastructure. No one," he's talking about the bike lane here, "no one who advocated it has ever been outdoors on the Bay Bridge. It's 7 miles across in cold wind and fog with a 250 climb either way. It competes with bikes on BART, who are relaxing bikes in the rush hour, and they may want to address those concerns."
Well, I think you just look at the Golden Gate, how many people go over that, and in the ratio of that to the car traffic, I think you're going to see the same thing on the Bay Bridge. You know, it's not a long ride on a bike, by the way.
You know, look at the new Carquinez Bridge, the Zampa Memorial Bridge. I'm a fifth-generation Vallejoan. I know how cold it gets out there on that strait, and I predicted we'd only see this people using it in the spring, and it's used year-round. The biking culture in this region is tremendous. So we're preparing to see heavy usage of that bike path.
I just add Clive to Anderson. I've been out on that bridge at all hours of the day and night, and I will tell you, the views are spectacular. We work to maximize views. You know, sunrise, sunset. I mean, we live in one of the most beautiful places in the world.
Start doing a little fiddler on the roof for us.
There you go.
This bridge is going to attract people, and they're going to enjoy the crossing.
Well, Paul has a question. "Has any consideration been given to the possible distracting effect of these changing shadows on the deck, especially for westbound drivers looking into the sunset?"
Well, the shadows would be, you know, the only area where there's any real shadows when you go into the cables. And that's when you come out of the tunnel, and so you go through this, what I call a veil of light or veil of cables. They stack up when you look through them, and not so you can't see through them, but you look straight ahead, and the decks are side by side. So I don't see where there's going to be a lot of shadowing to worry about.
I think this question's for you, Clive. Susan writes, "You bought your LEDs in Iowa? How is it with all the technological innovation, California lights couldn't be purchased in our state? What a shame."
Well, I'm not sure I'm the one to answer that question. We went to the people we felt were most qualified to help us build this bridge and make that lighting happen, and I couldn't be happier with the group that we're working with.
Yeah, yeah. Musco's amazing. You know, we have seen technology change in the process of developing and building this bridge. We were confronted with a challenge of needing to upgrade our design. They jumped in with us and helped us realize it. One of the things that is amazing to see with this new lighting system is that it was designed such that you don't see the fixtures. You don't actually know where the light is coming from. You see the poles, but the road surface glows. So that's a great concept, but how do you realize it? Well, Musco is a company that is, they are like the go-to company for lighting soccer fields and NASCAR. They've worked on, and you could just go to their website and see all the things they worked on, and they were able to solve the problem for us.
All right, Bart, you probably may have anticipated this. We did a program on the whole controversy over steel from China, and in fact, it's in our archives if you want to read it. Bruce writes, how do you address the criticism concerning the manufacture of bridge sections outside of the United States? And what was your reaction to the billboard that proclaimed 100% Chinese steel that was up near the bridge?
Right. Well, and we did that. And you know, the billboard was inaccurate. And the people that put it up there knew that it was when they did so, because they wanted to call attention to this issue that's happening in the United States right now of jobs. And so what we were faced with on the Bay Bridge is that we needed this particular bridge to be built within a certain amount of time. The capacity just was not here. There was no coalition that could come and actually give us those parts of the bridge. So we had to competitively build it. We bid it. We used state funds and local funds to do it. And that's how we have the bridge today. But the thing that's lost in this is how much American manufacturing has gone into this, how much American knowledge. Over 70%, more like 75% of the steel is fabricated right here in America. 30 different states contributed, most of them right here in California, and a primary one, my hometown, I'll give a shout out, Vallejo, California, XKT on Mare Island, thank you.
Helps them not stay in bankruptcy, in fact, one hopes. Newt writes, as an East Bay Hills resident, I really enjoyed watching the bridge go up. If I recall, during the original design phase, there was some political input for cost versus aesthetics. Didn't Arnold want plain vanilla? Glad that didn't happen.
Couldn't agree more.
Climate is right.
No, we testified as architects at the Transportation Commission in Sacramento to counter his concerns about that. And we found at the time when we did a quick analysis, and I think T.Y. Lin even took a look at it too, that replacing it with a viaduct now would lessen the span to 750 feet. And you need about 1,000 feet for two-way traffic for bigger boats. And we'd have to have three more foundations. We only have one out there. We'd have to have three more. We'd have to re-engineer both sections that would connect the main span. And so in the end, it was really a wash, and the time delay, I think, was 2 years or something. So it was nothing that wasn't really positive stuff in the end.
Yeah. And I'm going to go to more of your calls and remind you that you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website where you can also see pictures of the bridge as it's going to look when it's completely unveiled, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Ephraim, you're on the air with us. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I was a member of the EDAP panel, so I was in it from the beginning. And I want to give a few shout-outs to the designers that haven't been mentioned. The tower concept, the seismic design of splitting the tower, that was Frieder Seible, a professor at UC San Diego. Now, the design of the bridge itself, the original concept from which the aesthetic of the bridge flows, was Herb Rothman, engineer from New York. And his concept was the one that won the day. Originally, it was as was mentioned, a symmetrical design. And then, after a two-week study period, the tower was shifted to give the asymmetrical aspect that won the day. And I'm happy to say that I was one of those that suggested and advocated for that. So I wanted to just comment to give credit to those two gentlemen.
Okay, we thank you for that. Good to hear shout-outs here. And Don from our webpage asks, and Don McDonald, I'll go to you on this. Please explain to listeners what a self-anchored suspension bridge is and how it is different from Golden Gate Bridge design.
I think it is the cables go down to the deck. And the forces in the deck, there's two vectors to the forces. The direct force goes right down the cable, but it has two components. One is horizontal, one is vertical. When it comes parallel to the deck, the vertical component drops out and the pressure is put back on the deck. It's not anchored into the ground like a regular suspension bridge like the Golden Gate has anchorages at both ends. And on the west end of this bridge, it appears there's anchorages down there, but they're not. The concrete balances the bridge, the whole span that's on the other side, on the east side. But there are elements that rods that go into the ground that are there for earthquakes. It's like a bent that holds it in place in a major earthquake. So the basic idea is that it doesn't go into the ground. The cables go down. They lose their forces, the vertical force when they hit the deck. Puts the deck in compression.
You could look again on our website and see the images of what it looked like. And Amy writes to us here by email. Amy from Oakland, glad to see from the images that we'll actually be able to see the bay when driving in a small car, as the bridge is now. You can't see over the wall unless you're driving a van or an SUV. Greg writes, this will be a great bridge, but let's not forget why it is being built. We had a terrible earthquake in 1989 that showed us how vulnerable we are. After looking at the existing east span, it was determined that it had to be replaced. The process that followed was, dictated by Quentin Kopp, irresponsible, and a seismic safety project turned into a local fiasco, given that nearly 300,000 vehicles must use a bridge that was determined to be less than optimal. So far, we have dodged the bullet, and the existing bridge has not had to be tested in another major quake. I hope we make it. On our webpage, Chris writes, I'm big on recycling. Could your guests talk about what is to happen to the huge amount of raw materials contained in the Old Bay Bridge?
Well, right now we are getting ready. One of our contracts is out already to completely take down the old east span of the Bay Bridge when we put the new one in service. And the idea there is that the bulk steel would become the property of the demolition contractor, so that they can resell it as scrap and thus bring the cost of demolishing it down through a competitive bid. But what's unique about this bridge, and was unique about the removal of the 1927 Carquinez Bridge, is that these structures are historically relevant. They're on the National Registry of Historic Places or eligible for it. So we have to mitigate for the loss. So we have to identify key components of these structures and preserve them, offer them to local museums, and actually do full exposés on what these structures mean from an engineering standpoint and from a local traffic management standpoint.
Actually, we've got a listener here, Mary, who says, can Bart speak about the planned bridge museum?
Oh, the planned bridge museum. Okay. Well, that's design too, right, guys? In our environmental document, one of the things that we're doing is creating Gateway Park in Oakland, and that's in development right now. You can go to MTC's website and read more. I believe there's a gatewaypark.org website as well. Inside of that, there's an old, it's called the Irby's Building, or we call it the Sawtooth Building. You can see it when you're coming up to the queue on the Bay Bridge. The old trains that used to run across the lower deck of the Bay Bridge were serviced here. Caltrans has used it as a maintenance building, and we are in the process of converting it into a transportation museum where you'll find key components that we will preserve from the old bridge and others, and also be looking forward to new technologies that are going to be used in transportation at this location right there in West Oakland.
All right, I got a lot of calls to go to, and we'll try to get to as many as we can, but I want to ask you one more question, Bart, because as you may recall, we did a show with Sacramento Bee reporter who raised some questions about shoddy construction, and Brian, and you can find that in our archives, by the way. Brian asks, what about allegations that there was shoddy construction, that some of the concrete may not, in fact, have been cured correctly, and is the bridge safe?
Yeah, well, I'll take you back to that conversation very briefly. We have a process for determining exactly how our concrete cures. Every single test that Caltrans initiates was passed for the main foundation of the SAS tower. It is safe. The test that the B referred to was an additional test that was done before our testing by the contractor. That was not required as part of the process of determining the strength of the concrete. So it was irrelevant in our frame.
And Michael Fitzpatrick, just a quick question from a listener to you, if I may. How is the main cable protected, Bruce wants to know, from water intrusion into the strands?
Well, suspension bridges are made up of, and the Bay Bridge is no different than any other major suspension bridge, of smaller bands of cable. And so the main cable is made up of how many bundles, Bart?
137
bundles. So all those bundles are then compressed, and then they're wrapped, and then they're sheathed, actually. So water can't get in. because of the sheathing around the main cable. And Bart, you might want to add to the actual cable.
First of all, the individual wires, 17,399 of them, all are galvanized. And then we compact them so that they're really tight and we don't have as much void space on the inside of the cable. And then we wrap a zinc-based paste around the outside of the cable as we begin the process that you can see happening right now. We're using something that, if you looked at it in cross-section, would look like an S. It's a wire that we wrap radially around the outside of the cable so that it interlocks and we can get the least amount of moisture penetration through that S wire. So now we've made it through the galvanizing, the zinc-based paste that almost forms like a gasket around the outside of the cable, the S wire wrap, and then on top of that wrap, there's a three-coat paint process that protects it from corrosion.
And on we go to more of your calls. Bob, join us. Welcome to Forum.
Thanks. You know, I live in Berkeley and work in San Francisco, and one of the most amazing engineering parts of this is that you've kept me going to work all this time. And I'm sort of curious to know how much of the effort in putting this bridge together had to be put into the diversions, the curve, and the various temporary measures that were required. And it's amazing from an engineering standpoint, but I wonder in proportion to the total, what was the cost of doing that to make it possible for me to get to work?
What a great question. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you're looking at one of the most difficult parts of this job was keeping the 280,000 vehicles moving as we put whole new sections of bridge in the exact same footprint as the original bridge without, you know, Harry Houdini on the payroll. So it's a significant amount. I don't have a dollar amount for all of those different operations that we've done. But it started with a process that we did on the west approach, on the western side, where we had to demolish a significant size of the bridge. We came up with the processes we need to inform the public there. And then in 2007, when we started these huge demolitions with roll-ins of 5,000 tons of concrete, and then in 2009, when we did the one 150 feet in the air, the design of those things took over a year. The steel fabrication that came from Washington and Oregon and was shipped down here, that took a year. Those work crews worked through rain and snow. Let's see. It's in the hundreds of millions of dollars that these detours have cost.
Wow. Thank you for that question. And we go to another caller, Martin, joining us from Alameda. Hi, Martin. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to thank Bart Ney and Clive Endress and all the other great engineers and architects at Caltrans for their sponsorship of the ACE mentoring program in the local East Bay high schools. And that they have just been tremendous over the past 9 years to take their time in the middle of all this building to care about the future of California students, and we've gotten probably 30-40 scholarships of new engineers and architects through their time and effort, and I want to thank them publicly. They've been awesome.
As you've done, and we thank you for that. Appreciate it. Here's some Facebook comments. David writes, fitting honor for what seems like the world's largest, longest construction project. I think the Great Pyramid took only a little longer to build. Joanne writes, I think it looks great. But two questions. Why was the current design decided against in 1932, and how does the new design improve the safety of the bridge? Well, we've been kind of talking about that greater safety, especially with earthquake. Let's get into some of the specifics. But, Bart, you want to handle that first part?
I think we can connect what the last caller said, too, because it almost brings tears to my eyes. But one of the main reasons that we built this bridge is to inspire. Seismic safety, yes. Getting people around while we built it, yes. The third primary reason, the reason why we're here architecturally, is we want to inspire the next generation of engineers, because Caltrans and any other technological entity in this country knows that we don't have the students studying the sciences right now to come and fill in the jobs that we're currently doing. So we've been trying to inspire them. In 1932, when they were designing the original Bay Bridge, suspension bridges were called into question many times because they were a newer bridge technology, even though they've been around for a century or longer. And so when you got to the eastern span of the Bay Bridge, the cost associated with building two bridges to get one was probably the key contributing factor to determining that they would go with a different type of structure. What they were weighing back then most likely was the cost of building the temporary structure to hold up the bridge and doing that load transfer with creating a massive anchorage out in the middle of the bay.
So want to talk a little bit more, Don McDonald, about the safety of the bridge? I mean, some people hear 1,500 years and skepticism arises and so forth. How do you know you're going to really protect the bridge?
That's really a question for the engineers, in the sense that when we design these bridges, we go back and forth with aesthetics and engineering, like Michael was saying earlier. And one of the things is to have the bridge read aesthetically like it's really going to stand up. I mean, that's one of the subliminal aspects that I always look at. And I'm working on bridges all over the United States right now, which has been great. But the idea is that each bridge has to have 150-year life to it now. So there's endurance built into the bridge, and there's a redundancy. In other words, it's not like a building. The earthquake analysis is totally different. It's double what you do in a building. So in that sense, I think that that's one way to look at it.
Well, we're coming toward the end of the hour, and I'd be remiss, Bartney, if I didn't ask you about the logistics of the opening. What can you tell us at this point?
Well, that's something that that we're coordinating right now. We're looking at several things, but we're trying to tie it to history. The opening of the original Bay Bridge was a very significant milestone in our country. It provided jobs at a difficult time, just like this bridge does, and it provided a new way to cross the bay. It was the longest bridge of its type then. This is the longest bridge of its type now. So there are a lot of historical analogs that we're trying to connect as we're getting ready to celebrate the process of building this new bridge.
Well, congratulations to all of you. I mean, it's been an extraordinary feat and effort, and I commend you as much as I can and all the people who are involved in this. It's a great feat. And by the way, those of you who are fascinated with this can actually hear a panel discussion on Bay Area bridge design and aesthetics tonight from 6 to 8 at the Aquarium of the Bay, Pier 39. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to Bartney, Bay Bridge Communications Manager for California Department of Transportation, and thanks to Clive Endres, the Senior Landscape Architect for the California Department of Transportation, and the two architects here with us, Donald McDonald, Principal and Donald McDonald Architects, and Michael Fitzpatrick, Bridge Architect for T.Y. Lynn International. Thanks to all of you, and thanks again for the work. And thanks to you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with 9 to 11 with an hour, 10 to 11 in the evening. As a repeat, Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.